This Be Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate, so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K through 12th grade curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. If you want to bring IXL to your school, you can learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. We're proud to be sponsored by MyFlex Learning. MyFlex Learning is a scheduling platform that helps middle and high schools meet the individual needs of all students. Schools can easily create and manage time for flex blocks, activity periods, RTI, therapy, and teacher appointments, and much more. With its built-in accountability tool and reporting features, MyFlex Learning solves your challenges around getting kids where they need to be and understanding how flex time is spent. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. This is Dr. Karen, and you are listening to the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network, where I share up-to-date, evidence-based practices, my own experience, and guest interviews designed to help pediatric therapists, educators, and aspiring school leaders design services that support social, emotional, and academic growth and set kids up for success in adulthood. Whether you want to learn effective strategies for your therapy session or classroom, be an influential leader on your team, or find creative ways to use your skills to advance in your career, I've got you covered. Hey there, it's Dr. Karen, and welcome to episode 158 of the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network. The most effective reading instructional practices aren't always the ones that gain traction. It's usually the ones with the most successful marketing campaigns. The best marketer wins, but this certainly isn't a win for the students who go without effective instruction or the school staff struggling to support them. That's why I was so excited to talk with Dr. Pamela Snow about the growing body of research relating to literacy and its impact on life outcomes, as well as how we can improve the discourse surrounding effective instruction and improve instructional practices. Dr. Pamela Snow is a professor of cognitive psychology in the School of Education at La Trobe University, Australia. She's also the co-director of the Science of Language and Reading Lab. She's also a registered psychologist and has taught a wide range of undergraduate and postgraduate education and health professionals. Her research has been funded by nationally competitive schemes such as the ARC Discovery Program, the ARC Linkage Program, and the Criminology Research Council. Her research concerns the role of language and literacy skills as academic and mental health protective factors in childhood and adolescence. She has conducted research on the profiles and needs of high-risk groups, such as youth offenders, children and adolescents in the state care system and flexible education systems, as well as research advancing evidence in the language to literacy transition in the early years of school. She established the Science of Language and Reading Lab at La Trobe with her colleague, Professor Tanya Siri, and has been published in a wide range of international journals. She has over 170 publications comprising refereed papers, books, and book chapters, monographs, and research reports. In addition to these academic outputs, she writes a popular blog for teachers, parents, and clinicians called The Snow Report. And finally, she is the founding associate editor of the Reading League Journal. You're definitely going to want to check the show notes because she mentioned a ton of fantastic authors and resources that you're going to want to check out. A lot of what we discuss in this conversation is highly relevant to what I teach in my signature program, Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, my program for speech pathologists, and other language and literacy professionals who want a research-based framework for building the language skills to support background knowledge and comprehension. Language Therapy Advanced Foundations provides a framework for language therapy that's designed to be delivered in conjunction with a robust reading curriculum, so you can give kids the foundation they need to be successful in school and in life. To learn more about the program, go to drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. Now, please enjoy this interview with Dr. Pamela Snow. Today, I am joined by Dr. Pamela Snow. So thank you so much for being here with me today.
It's my pleasure, Karen. Thank you.
Well, I thought we would start off by having you share a little bit about yourself. So the history of your career and what you're doing now.
Oh, well, because I'm old, that's a long history, Karen. I am a professor of cognitive psychology in the School of Education at La Trobe University in Victoria, Australia. La Trobe University is quite geographically dispersed, and I'm at the largest regional campus in Bendigo, which is about 2 hours north of Melbourne. My other hat that I wear in the School of Education is that I am co-director and co-founder with my colleague, Professor Tanya Seri, of the Science of Language and Reading Lab, or SOLA Lab. By background, like you, I'm a speech language pathologist. I'm also a registered psychologist.
Wow. So, and I know that you have done really a lot of work that has impacted people all over the world, not just Australia. I know that you're very well known in the US and Canada as well.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Thank you. The internet has certainly made the world a smaller place.
It has. It's really interesting.
Years. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about, there was one post that you had written, and I know that you've talked about this on another podcast, but I thought it was really helpful because with reading, I think it's great that the science of reading is, I don't want to say trending because it's science. It should have been what we were doing all along. But I know that, as you said, with social media, it's just really interesting how information gets shared and how ideas get spread. And so I would love to talk about some of the common areas of debate about literacy and education reform and what's going on in school. Well, and I have some specific things I wanted to ask you about, but from your perspective, what are the common things that you see being debated or misconceptions or points of confusion?
So social media, I guess, is a double-edged sword in that it does allow for the spread and dissemination of sharing of information and ideas, but not necessarily with a quality control filter. So that makes it in some respects a messy space, but I think we have to take the good with the bad. In that, I think it's made it much easier for teachers in particular to be part of the discourse around what scientific evidence does and doesn't say with respect to reading, the nature of reading, and what makes for high quality, impactful, purposeful reading instruction. One of my big beefs over the years has been that teachers have been excluded, really. Overtly or covertly from that debate by virtue of the fact that in most cases in English-speaking countries such as yours and mine, their pre-service education about literacy has been very strongly influenced by whole language, more latterly balanced literacy. students, education students, in many cases aren't even introduced to the idea that reading is a contested space, that reading instruction is a contested space. They're given, LORE, principles about reading instruction that are presented as fact and not even contested. And then they experience a number of aftershocks, I think, once they start working as classroom teachers, and they start to realize that for many students, these things that they were given as, being sort of written on tablets and handed down by Moses to the masses, they don't actually work for a lot of students. And little bit by little bit, they discover that there are other ways of thinking about reading and other ways of teaching reading. So one of my sort of driving forces, I suppose, has been to bring teachers into the discussion and to try and give them equal voice and the capacity to have equal voice, because we also know that, unfortunately, many initial teacher education degrees don't equip teachers to be critical consumers of research. So then study a lot about research methodology, how research is done, what the quality control pipeline is for new knowledge, and how to critically appraise a research paper. Now, I say that with full knowledge of the fact that for most allied health professionals, that's probably not something that graduates would see as an area of strength necessarily. I've taught a lot of allied health students over the years, including obviously speech language pathology students. And I think most of them would say, oh, I'm not super confident on research methods, but they have at least been exposed to research methods, to the scientific method. And when I say the scientific method, I'm not just talking about positivist quantitative research. We should be talking about rigorous research regardless of paradigm. There's high quality quantitative research, there's low quality quantitative research, and the same applies in quant and qual research methods. So social media has perhaps kind of lifted the veil for many teachers, remembering, of course, that we have no idea what percentage of teachers engage with social media, what we used to call Twitter, we now are meant to call X.
Well, now it's probably TikTok.
And I haven't got to TikTok yet.
What's going on over there?
that's another frontier that I perhaps need to think about. I'm a relatively recent newcomer to even LinkedIn. Yeah. I am very active on Twitter or X. There's still a lot of teachers who aren't engaging at all, like I would imagine, with this, but at least it's made it a more level playing field and created a platform where there's two-way exchange. So I get a lot out of listening to teachers on social media and getting a better understanding of what the challenges are that they experience every day in their classrooms, just as much as I would hope that teachers get something out of hearing what researchers are saying. There are some really good conference platforms now, like ResearchEd, where teachers, practitioners, researchers come together for two-way exchange. In Australia, we have a terrific platform called Sharing Best Practice, which is a very low-cost, accessible platform, like research ed conferences are always held on a Saturday, so teachers don't have to get permission to attend. Of course, that means that they're giving up half of their weekend, but motivated teachers do that and do
they
that.
They definitely do.
And the speakers speak for free and so forth. So I think, you know, we've moved into a space where there is much better exchange and openness and accessibility of high quality knowledge. But I still think at a teacher pre-service education level, certainly here in Australia, we've got a big blockage in the knowledge translation pipeline. So there's a lot of unevenness in Australian universities, and I think in US universities and Canada and New Zealand, other places as well, mm-hmm. with respect to what knowledge is privileged in pre-service teacher education and what knowledge is sidelined. And often that's because of the paradigm that it comes from and a perception that if research wasn't done by teachers, then it's not worthy of putting in front of teachers.
Yeah, there is kind of that two-way street, I think. And I do think it's good that with social media, you can have that ongoing feedback loop of, is the research useful? Are we taking teacher feedback and needs into account? But also that the researchers are continuing to be able to understand where we can educate about the just being good consumers of it as well. Because I know that sometimes I've looked at things where you can clearly tell that it's a marketing campaign. It's not a research article. When you're seeing these methods being promoted and it's the same authors over and over again, to me, that's a big red flag. And it doesn't mean that it's bad, but it might mean that there needs to be more rigorous research about that method aside from the people who authored it. Mm. Or when you are just seeing very small case studies and there's not really any efforts to move beyond that. And I know that a lot of times when you are working with certain populations, it is harder to get those big research studies done and it takes a long time. And I think that from the practitioner standpoint, people are saying, I don't have 20 years to wait for you to give me the research studies. I have humans in front of me right now. So exactly. I understand the frustration of why some people kind of get a bad taste in their mouth from interacting with the academic side. But mm-hmm. at the same time, when you have kids who are getting instruction that is causing them to not be able to read, and then all of the negative impacts that could cause, that's an issue as well. So
it's very challenging, and it's actually very difficult when people start doing their own research, as you know from your experience.
Yeah.
What they discover is just why there are so many unanswered questions, because it's so difficult and cumbersome and expensive and time consuming mm-hmm. to do research. So, you know, we know there are countless numbers of important questions that we can't necessarily dial up, you know, rigorous, high quality research to give us a definitive answer. So we have to gather information from the sources that we have and look at alignment with robust, well-regarded, tested theories of reading, and do what Steve Dykstra so eloquently talks about. You know, you've probably seen, and your listeners might have seen, his target metaphor. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the fact that, you know, there's only a limited amount of research to support what goes on in the bullseye of the target. The further you move out from that bullseye, the thinner the research evidence gets, but that doesn't remove the imperative for us to be thinking about alignment with theoretical principles, mm-hmm. And, you know, dropping breadcrumbs, if you like, conceptually, to say, well, if we're going to do this thing, how well does it align with a robust theory of reading, like the simple view of reading, or like Seidenberg's four-part processor model, or Kate Nation's updated model of the simple view of reading. Is there a theoretical alignment, not just, okay, we're just going to go off and do this thing? And I think education has a history of just going off and doing this thing. There's been a lot of fads and fashions in education where, as Louisa Motz said more than 20 years ago, that any idea in education that can muster a vigorous advocate has been seen as worthy of being entertained. A vigorous advocate might just be a very noisy person, a charismatic person, an influential person. And so that means ideas get translated into practice very often without any theoretical foundation or empirical support. In the United States, you have an FDA, Food and Drug Administration. In Australia, we have a corollary body called the Therapeutic Goods Administration. So in health, there are processes that have to be gone through before new drugs or devices can be implemented into practice, as there should be, but we don't have that same filtering process in education. We don't have a body that says, you know, is reading recovery a good way to address the needs of struggling readers? And if we did have such a body, maybe reading recovery wouldn't have found its way into schools in the first place. And I think education is starting to engage, or some sectors are starting to engage with the idea of evidence-based, evidence-informed practice, but there are still some tendencies to flip-flop around which are unhelpful.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there are a lot of initiatives and people who are in leadership positions, people who are at the companies that are selling products to schools. It's very much about science of reading, but then there's the question of how are they defining what science of reading is and what it looks like. So yes, I'm happy that they're using that language and that there's a lot about phonics instruction and the reading rope. And so I think that makes me feel optimistic, but at the same time, I know that there are I still hear the stories of what's going on and the trainers that are being brought in to do professional development in schools that are maybe aligned with approaches that we know aren't effective for the struggling readers. So, and it takes time.
That term science of reading, it needs to be used in lowercase. It's not a brand. It's not a proper noun. It's an evolving body of knowledge that inevitably is going to be contested, and there are going to be debates. You know, we've seen debates about phonemic awareness instruction without text attached. With, you know, should we be doing standalone phonemic awareness training? Now, that's the kind of debate that should be going on. There's been a bit of a debate. I don't know whether it's been this is kind of trending in the US, but you know, should we be doing speech to print, print to speech?
All those debates.
Instruction. These are the things we should be debating, and there is a tendency on the part of detractors to say, oh, well, look, they can't even agree amongst themselves. So therefore, you know, there's no such thing as a science of reading, and we can just continue to essentially do whatever we think is best in our classrooms. That's not a logical or intellectually defensible position to take. It's not a position that we would endorse on the part of medical professionals and other health professionals to say, well, something's contested, so therefore we'll just do whatever we like. And if education wants to have the standing of a well-regarded profession, then it's going to have to engage with the accountability that other professions have to engage with around how decisions are made.
Yeah. I'd love to go through when we're thinking about all the different debates that come up at the different ages. I mean, we've got debates at preschool, then we have elementary when kids are really learning to read. And then you have the late elementary when we're not learning to read, we're reading to learn. And then we have high school where you would hope that most kids would be reading. And now we're thinking about vocation and what's, you know, vocational placements and what are kids going to do after high school. So I'd love to go through and, you know, I have some different things that I've noticed that have popped up at all the different places. And I'd love to know your thoughts on how to think about those things. So we started with early education. There is the question of, and again, I think that there's multiple questions under this where it's, what should we be doing? What does good early literacy instruction look like? And when is the ideal age to start? And I'm going to use big air quotes here, teaching kids to read, because I know that means different things to different people, because there's the debate about when does the print come in, especially when you have the transition from preschool to kindergarten. How does play-based learning fit in? And then the other thing is, and this happens in the US, where people look at other countries that are doing very well according to their assessment and say, well, look at how well they're doing in this country. We should be doing that in the US because this other country is doing well. And let's take that as a model for how we reform what's going on in another country. And that just becomes a huge conversation. So I would love your thoughts on that. And I know that that's about 20 questions. I guess.
That is about 20 questions. I'll see which ones I can.
Yeah.
I think a really important distinction that has had more emphasis, more explicit emphasis in the last 10 years or so in the reading space has been the distinction between biologically primary and biologically secondary skills, and the fact that oral language is biologically primary. So this is drawing on the work of David Geary, amongst other people. And so, you know, all other factors being equal, children are going to acquire oral language. Now, that's not to say, and I emphasize this, that oral language is set and forget, because it isn't. The key adults in children's worlds, so the parents, preschool teachers, you know, other adults, childcare workers and so forth, are having a big input. And if you listen to the way parents engage with children, it's often quite purposeful at various points in the day in terms of how they're explaining vocabulary, explaining idioms, and scaffolding children's language use. So it's not, yes, it's biologically primary, but we have to deal with the paradox, I suppose, that it's not set and forget, but reading, writing and spelling skills are definitely biologically secondary. So they're things that our brains haven't evolved to do on their own. We have as Steven Pinker describes it, a language brain that can become a reading brain if it is exposed, and ideally in the appropriate developmental window, which is, you know, probably age 5 to 8, to instruction that helps children to understand the purposes of print and the way that print and speech map to each other. In English, that means in a relatively, well, quite a dense orthography for historical reasons. So when we talk about things like a play-based curriculum, I think play is an entirely appropriate focus in the preschool years for developing language skills, social interaction skills, sharing, you know, all the kinds of reciprocity kind of processes, imagination, awareness and appreciation of culture and so forth. Play is the appropriate medium, and children are going to naturally spend a lot of their time playing anyway. And
you would hope.
And we'll pick up you know, a box and imagine that it's a car or a doll, or you know, that again, that's quite sort of biologically primary. But I think we have to be careful to understand that we don't develop biologically secondary skills through something like play. So play is important for a range of reasons, but we can't be relying on play to get children across that bridge from something that's biologically primary and natural to something that's biologically secondary and if you like, unnatural. You know, it's not natural for us to read, write, and spell. We can do it. It happens to have very significant cultural value, and you know, if you like, economic value for us as individuals and as nations to be literate, but we need to be taught how to become literate. And I don't think that distinction has been emphasized nearly enough in pre-service education. I don't think we should be saying it's either or, that it's, you know, in preschools that they should be doing either a play-based curriculum or pre-literacy activities that help children identify letters and some letter sounds and so forth. Why can't we be doing both? You know, this should not be, in my opinion, in opposition to each other, but we should be understanding that the preschool year is a transition year, where children are moving from the social, the interactional, the relational, the experiential into something that is going to be more instructional, because school is essentially where you go to develop those biologically secondary skills. So we wouldn't expect children to pick up algebra through play.
Right, exactly.
To pick up reading, writing, and spelling through play. So I think it just needs a more nuanced kind of discussion, and we can allay a lot of anxieties if we appreciate that we can be doing both and doing both in a purposeful kind of way.
I'm going to take a quick break here to talk about Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, my program for SLPs who want to create a research-based framework for language therapy. When many people start the program, they are working on comprehension goals. Usually these goals might be surrounding things like following directions, WH questions, stating the main idea of things that they're reading. And while all of these skills might make sense in certain contexts, many of them are finding that their students just aren't making progress. And that's because, as we discuss in this conversation, comprehension is not an isolated skill, but rather a construct that has a lot of different things woven in that overlap with each other. That's why the framework that I teach centers around teaching vocabulary and background knowledge, but also gives you a framework for some of the other language skills that are going to support that high-level comprehension. Things like semantics, syntax, orthography, so things that are going to build vocabulary, things that are going to support metacognition and independent word learning, and also be an important piece that can be implemented in conjunction with a robust reading curriculum. To learn more about the program, you can go to drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. Let's talk about flex time in schools. The potential benefits to our students make it worth exploring. More time for personalized learning. Increased choice and agency for students. Dedicated time for intervention. Overall, as school leaders, it gives us and our faculty more tools to increase academic achievement. But the implementation and management of flex time can be a challenge. Tricky logistics and a lack of clear accountability systems can prevent teachers from buying in and can hold us back from ensuring students make good use of their time. I'm pleased to share that MyFlex Learning provides a solution to these challenges and more. MyFlex Learning helps you create and manage flex time for any purpose. Want to see it for yourself? Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year of use. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
This is a thought that popped into my head as I was just having different conversations about, because I have people ask, well, what apps can I use to build my child's language skills, or what things can I be giving parents to do at home? And I love audiobooks. I think they're a great tool, but we do have to understand that listening comprehension is different than reading comprehension. And I love an audiobook as something to do on a family road trip or as part of what you're doing to build language skills, especially if it's a book that a child can't read yet, but that we also need to be spending time with print. And that tends to get, I've noticed that people get a little heated with some of those conversations. And something that I thought about was, well, if you like people who know how to read through Braille, they have to learn how to do it. We wouldn't expect someone to listen to a book and know how to read Braille. And none of us know how to do it. We would have to learn how to do it to map those symbols. So to think that we would be able to read visual print symbols without direct instruction wouldn't make sense either.
No, but that really has been a central premise of a lot of reading instruction over decades. The idea that immersing children in text and in high quality, so-called authentic children's literature. And Kenneth Goodman, I think it's fair to say, didn't accept the distinction between oral language and reading. You know, his argument was that, well, children pick up oral language from immersion and experience, and therefore that's how we should be fostering their reading development. Now, you and I both know that there's a percentage of children who do seem to seamlessly get their regardless of the pedagogy that they're exposed to. We don't know exactly what percentage that is, and there's no doubt genetic factors, social, environmental, individual factors that coalesce to make that small group of children very fortunate. But of course, we can't build entire education systems around the profiles of that small group of fortunate children. That said, I think it's more convenient for education systems to teach in ways that seem to work for that small group of children. Maybe it's more, or it has been historically perhaps more enjoyable for teachers to be reading big books and talking about stories and doing guided reading and hoping that kids are just picking it up via osmosis. The problem, as you and I both know and your listeners know, is that that leaves a very significant proportion of children behind. They become what Reid Lyon described as instructional casualties. And then there's a discourse around, oh, well, their parents didn't read to them enough in the preschool years, or they're not motivated, or they're not trying hard enough, or maybe they've got dyslexia. But maybe there's a significant proportion of children who just haven't been exposed to the kind of impactful teaching that means that they get it, that they understand that these symbols on the page, loosely, sometimes closely, but not always, represent speech, that there's a system here, it's a code, I can learn the code, and then I can develop automaticity in getting words off the page, and then I can become someone who sees the purpose of reading and enjoys reading. But unfortunately, I think the cart's been put before the horse in many cases, and people have tried to start with a love of reading, but hard to love something that you can't do.
I know. Yeah. I mean,
there's many things I can't do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think that it kind of points fingers in the wrong places, you know, like you said, and not that parents shouldn't be doing certain things at home to support what's going on at school. But also on the teachers in the schools that maybe don't have access to the tools and the resources, if you need to do some changes to the curriculum and give the teachers the information that they need so that they can put those interventions, or even just not just for the kids who are struggling, but for the kids who are in the entire class, because then you're going to have further problems down the line if you put it in place.
You know, I get quite a lot of flack when I say things in blog posts or on social media about the fact that we shouldn't be blaming parents when children struggle with reading. And when I say that it's the job of schools to teach children how to read, the job of parents, there are some people who really come out of their cages to debate that.
They for sure.
my position is that our challenge for ourselves should be to assume that, or to think about a world in which parents are across the board not doing very much at home to support language and literacy. So therefore, it all needs to be done at school, and school needs to be ready for children. Children don't just need to be ready for school, and they need to be ready for children at varying levels of, preschool experience of language and text. Because the schools that do take it upon themselves to change their instructional model and take responsibility really for children's learning generally see a huge uplift in achievement and in engagement, but there's also often a huge uplift in teacher satisfaction, because the teachers are realizing that the learning that's going on is as a direct consequence of the instruction, the teaching that's occurring. And teachers often say to me, I had no idea what a five-year-old could do in the reading and writing space until I started teaching explicitly with a scope and sequence. And then they never want to go back to teaching the way that they were before with, using predictable texts and banks of sight words and cueing when they see that. But then teachers feel empowered, I think, to say that, and, you know, as Anita Archer says, how well I teach is how well my students learn. Rather than saying, well, there's a group of children in my class who haven't learnt, and that's because their parents don't do enough at home. That is not okay, and it doesn't pass the logic test when you see that there are families that obviously are doing a lot at home, but still sometimes have children who struggle with reading, writing, and spelling.
Yeah, and I think that is, you know, unless you have parents who are choosing to homeschool, whenever I am asked about what can parents do at home to support reading, I'm really uncomfortable with trying to get too into the weeds, because I know that this pool of people that has gone to college to be teachers or speech pathologists or reading specialists, that they have so much to learn. How am I, with my online content, going to give parents something that would be useful? So I usually say, that's great that we want to have some connection between home and school, but the majority of the direct instruction, and really all of it, should happen at school. And then we can have some practice activities. Parents can provide a space for the practice to happen. And And we know that some families might not be able to do that, but for the ones that want to, it can be the practice.
We absolutely endorse and encourage that, but we can't be saying that children can't succeed if the home language and literacy environment is not strong. Mm-hmm. Children have to be able to succeed because of the quality of what's going on in their classrooms, irrespective and perhaps in spite of gaps that might exist in the home language and literacy environment, because there are parents who themselves can't read, mm-hmm. who have a lot of anxiety in relation to literacy, who had negative experiences themselves at school and feel embarrassed and perhaps even triggered by the reading space.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, largely a hidden problem. So I think we get around that by taking essentially really a public health approach and saying, let's do the best that we can at a population level to prevent reading difficulties through high quality instruction. And of course, that's what RTI and more latterly MTSS is all about. Mm-hmm. It's saying, let's just absolutely get it right from the outset, so that the vast majority of children succeed as a result of the high quality instruction that they're exposed to in classrooms. And then our limited intervention resources are actually available for the right small percentage of children who perhaps do have some form of neurodiversity that is holding them back in the reading space, whether it's a language disorder or, you know, other factors like autism or intellectual disability that are going to potentially make it a bit harder, not impossible, but a bit harder. So those children are going to need more support. But at the moment, I think in too many schools, because the instructional model isn't as sharp and as focused as it could be, there are too many children seeping through, needing tier two in particular intervention services, and most schools just don't have the resources to adequately meet the needs of those students. And then we see the Keith Stanovich Matthew effect to really kick in. And as you know, the more time that goes by, the harder and harder it gets to catch students up. And then we're dealing with secondary psychosocial sequelae that start to kick in as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that that's, you know, we're kind of talking about the early elementary years when it is really important to do that direct instruction. And one of the things that has been where I've seen some pushback, I would say towards the later elementary years, when you're getting into secondary, when the kids who have responded to the curriculum or are progressing at the rate that we would expect, everything's going as planned for them, and they're ready to move on to the content areas so that they can benefit from their academic experience. And one of the things that came up when I was interacting with people in the schools was, well, comprehension is the whole point, so we should be working on comprehension. And I know I get this a lot from the speech pathologists who are going through some of my programs, where it's comprehension is the issue and that is the symptom that's being reported. So mm-hmm. shouldn't we just be working on comprehension? And so there's that debate at the, I would say, the late elementary, early secondary level. And then what if that's still an issue for those kids who are older and now we need to prepare them for life? And mm-hmm. I know that some kids can even be, depending on what their family situation is, they're considering, do we want to go to college? But do you have the skills to be able to be successful in college? Or mm-hmm. even if you are not going to college, you still need good reading and writing skills to be in the workforce. So maybe we could talk the late elementary issue and then go on to the vocational. What does this mean for your life?
Well, the comprehension question is a really interesting and important one, because, yes, obviously the purpose of reading is to comprehend text. But we can't get past the fact that we've got to be able to get the words off the page in order to comprehend them, and not just simple CBC words. So it's not enough to be able to get words like mat and dog and can off the page, because English is a morphophonemic language. As we, you know, move beyond very simple decodable texts, we're going to be looking at polysyllabic, polymorphological words, and children need to have the ability to decode their way through increasingly long, complex words, which is why I, like a lot of people, think that morphology instruction is important once children have mastered the initial code cracking skills that they need. But I think we need to be thinking about comprehension as a process and not as a unitary skill. And there are a number of different sort of metaphors and paradigms for thinking about this. Nancy Hennessy talks about, in her Comprehension Blueprint book, talks about a factory assembly line, which I think is a really nice analogy. And she talks about all of the processes that need to occur on that assembly line, like word identification. So when we're talking about comprehension, we've still got to be talking about word identification, decoding, phonics, whatever you want to call it, vocabulary, understanding of sentence structure, background knowledge, inferential language. So all of these things need to be working synergistically in order for that thing that rolls off the end of the assembly line as comprehension to be working properly, to be functional. So if we're going to say we're going to work on comprehension, then we need to be purposefully working on all of those components. And that, of course, includes decoding ability. The only real reason that I and other people emphasize high quality, explicit, systematic, synthetic phonics instruction in the early years is to knock that barrier out of play to comprehension. You know, it's not because we want to be doing lots of drill practice. I mean, drill practice is important on understanding how speech and print map to each other, but we really want to knock a barrier out of the way to comprehension. So if we've got children to a point of automaticity, then we can be really, you know, we can look at the upper part of the reading rope, for example. That's where we would want the focus to be, recognizing that as students work through the primary or elementary years and into the secondary years, they are going to need to be able to find their way through increasingly morphologically complex words, words that have affixes. They need to be able to identify the base. The base, of course, carries most of the meaning, as Deb Wasser always emphasizes. So knowing the meanings of some of those Latin and Greek bases is really helpful and important. And knowing the meanings of the prefixes and suffixes. Now, a lot of the suffixes have got a inflectional, and so they've got syntactic meaning, if you like. They make words behave appropriately in sentences, where a lot of the prefixes have more of a semantic influence on words. So the prefix D has a very different influence than the prefix re or un, for example. And explicitly teaching those things to students is building comprehension. So I think we need to not be talking about comprehension as a unitary concept, which I know you're not, and thinking about the components of comprehension and how we're going to teach them. You know, we have a huge vocabulary in English for historical reasons. English has a much bigger vocabulary than many other languages because we've happily and busily over centuries appropriated words from other languages, but we haven't necessarily thrown out the ones that we already had, and that gives us these tiers of vocabulary. So there's often a word that exists at tier one, like pick, then it's got a corollary at tier two, like select. The tier one word will often be in children's oral language vocabulary, but they need to be exposed and have explicit teaching to be developing the more literate language at tier two. So, and of course, many words, even at tier one, have multiple meanings. Lots of tier one words are subject to this phenomenon called polysemy, where the meaning of a word is very different in different contexts. So children often have a word like bank stored in their vocabulary with a meaning, a place that parents go, less and less perhaps these days, as a physical building, a place where you put your money. They might then encounter that word in relation to a passage of text that's talking about a river. Because bank is a polysemous word, it's got different meanings in different contexts. Unless children are reading, they're not going to be encountering those different meanings of words. So comprehension is really a complex, dynamic, but very rich teaching space, I think. It creates really interesting opportunities for teachers and allied health professionals who are providing support to be targeting the components of comprehension, looking at inferential language. Why do we tell someone who's about to go and perform in a concert to break a leg? What on earth is that about? So actually explaining that very often we say things that we don't literally mean, and if we don't understand the non-literal meaning, then we're not going to actually understand what the speaker or writer is saying. So it's kind of a long-winded answer there, Karen, but I think to get students to the point of automaticity with getting words off the page is so important, so that we can continue their progress, their engagement with text, hopefully have students who enjoy reading. I think the evidence is pretty clear. The longitudinal evidence now is pretty clear that we have to have skill before we have the enjoyment. Skill comes before thrill, if you like. We don't have kids enjoying reading if they can't read. If it's a struggle, then they're not going to see the point.
Yeah, I think with the comprehension piece, as you said, where it's and I understand why people do this. They want to write their IEP goal. People are so concerned about the goal. And if you do that, then it's student will answer WH questions on 3 out of 4 trials. And it's so, and I do have people concerned where I'll say, okay, you need to be working on the vocabulary and the syntax and the morphology. And they get so worried about how do I write that into a goal? But I have a comprehension goal. How do I work on vocabulary when the goal is comprehension? Well, you are working on comprehension because it all fits together.
Getting that support does diminish.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask one more really quick question before we can hear about where people can connect with you. But I would love, and this is not really a 5-minute discussion, but there's just a lot of thoughts about the preparing students for life, and we're being too academic, we're too focused on the school traditional academic skills, and it's not, especially because of the way that the world is changing with technology, that we're not really giving kids those problem solving skills. So I'd love for you to weigh in on that debate quickly.
Well, I don't think in Australia that we are being too academic. I mean, it's very hard to make generalizations because different states, different sectors, and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
But I think if we, you know, we often hear talk of so-called 21st century skills like collaboration, cooperation, creativity, problem solving, all of those kind of things. But really, they're not 21st century skills. They've been around for millennia. How did the Great Pyramids get built if we didn't have collaboration and cooperation and creativity and problem solving? So, you know, we need to kind of fact check the idea that these are 21st
I like
century
that.
Skills. But I think it's also important to remember that, as a number of people have said, I think Natalie Wexler has said that knowledge is what we think with, that it's, you know, knowledge sticks to knowledge. And, you know, I can't problem solve about geology because I know nothing about geology. I have no background knowledge. So we need to be building students' knowledge of the world and of subject content areas so that they can think critically. You know, we want critical engagement with world politics, with civic matters, with local politics. But if students don't have background knowledge, then they're going to be very prone to fake news, to very superficial levels of analysis that they're exposed to in the media. I want to live in a knowledge-rich society. I want to live in a community where people do have a solid grasp of history and geography and cultural understandings. Now, of course, there's going to be some relativity in those spaces. You know, history is, you know, a contested space. So that's fine, but you can't even be part of a contested debate if you don't have some background knowledge. You know, we're hearing a lot about the tragic circumstances in the Middle East at the moment. But a lot of people would perhaps struggle to even point to Israel on a map, or, you know, when we hear about the West Bank, people might imagine that's on the western side of Israel, and it's actually not. It's on the eastern side of Israel, and you know, some background knowledge helps people to think about current events and to understand what's going on. So I strongly favour a knowledge-rich curriculum, which means explicit teaching, teacher-led instruction, starting with explicit teaching, by all means moving into some project-based learning after we've got students all to the same level. And I think, you know, that's what our secondary schools in particular should be really focusing on, building on the strong foundations, hopefully, that have been established in the elementary school years.
And
we need to support teachers to do that, because for many teachers, their initial teacher education did not prepare them to teach explicitly. Many teachers were told that explicit teaching is a bad thing, that they're almost cheating if they're explicitly teaching, and they need to be
boring kids.
Or boring kids.
Yeah.
You know, and I know from time spent in classrooms where high quality explicit teaching is occurring, that it's fast paced, it's interactive. All of the students are involved and engaged. Again, I'll quote Anita Archer, that learning isn't a spectator sport. So we don't have the capable, able students participating and the more reticent, perhaps struggling students holding back because they're not putting their hand up. So, you know, if we're applying good explicit teaching principles, we're having a no hands up policy, we're calling on non-volunteers in a very inclusive way, and promoting learning and, you know, socializing students into learning routines, that means that we're using their instructional time in a highly productive way. But that's a very big shift for many teachers in what they get up in the morning to go to their workplace to do. And not all teachers are up for that. Not all teachers want to change, for ideological reasons, perhaps, the way that they teach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's another whole discussion about
it is.
Whether we should be letting individual professionals choose their own adventure, or whether we should be saying, as professionals, you need to be applying the approaches that have the best evidence to support them, as we do with other professions.
And I know that you, in a recent post, talked a little bit about that, about the how much autonomy is, what should we be having in education? So we can link to that, because it's a really good article.
Less would be my answer, in a word.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I know. And it's a counterintuitive, almost controversial stance to take in some groups, depending on who you're talking to. So
that's right. Absolutely.
So where can people go to connect with you, learn about your work?
There's my blog post, the Snow Report, and my La Trobe University homepage. And we also now have a Solar Lab website, and I can send you those
That'd
links
be great.
If you don't already have them. I think most of them are in my electronic signature, actually. But they're probably and Twitter or X. I'm fairly active there. Not terribly active on other social media platforms. So they're probably the main ways.
Okay, great. Well, we'll link to all those things. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
It's been lovely to chat, Karen. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check the show notes for links to all of the resources and information about authors and experts that were mentioned in this episode. Also, be sure to check out Dr. Snow's blog, which I have linked to. I've also linked to that in the show notes, as well as some of my favorite articles that she's written recently. If you are an SLP and you want a framework for language therapy, if you feel like you don't have a good system and you're spending a ton of time planning, and you want a framework that's going to help you focus on the right skills that are going to make an impact on your students, then take a look at Language Therapy Advanced Foundations. To learn more about the program, you can go to drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. If you have a suggestion for a guest, or if you're interested in being a guest on De Facto Leaders, if you know someone who has shown leadership skills that has impacted K-12 education in some way, you can email me at talktome@drkarenspeech.com to suggest a guest for the show. As always, it helps me so much if you leave me a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you found this episode helpful, please share it with your friends or colleagues. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time. Do you want to simplify your school's technology, save teachers time, improve students' performance on state assessments without just teaching to the test? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/BE to learn how IXL's research-based teaching and learning platform can help you achieve all these goals. That's IXL.com/BE. There are lots of solutions out there for giving students what they need when they need it. But when do they actually do all of those things? You need flexible time. When added into the master schedule, flex time enables students to get extra help or intervention, meet with teachers, make up work, get physical exercise, and try new enrichment offerings. If you're thinking of giving it a try, check out My Flex Learning, which unlocks the benefits of flex time without the common challenges. Its intuitive design makes implementation and training a breeze. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off your first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE.